I would now like to introduce our main speaker tonight, Steve F.
Hi, everybody. I'm Steve, and I'm a recovered overeater.
Hi, Steve.
And I was sitting over there, and what I started thinking about was 4 years ago, my mother died. And I don't recall speaking at a meeting around that time. I may have, but I don't remember it. So I didn't have to, as I recall, speak with the kind of feelings that I feel. I don't feel I'm alone here, but that we're all kind of loaded with today. I feel extremely sad, and there's a lot of anger that's there too. And it's real hard for me to kind of move out of that space. And I guess I'm kind of thankful for OA because it allows me to feel that, you know, instead of stuffing it down with something. Okay, let's see. Well, I started out from about the age of 11 being a compulsive overeater, as I recall. My dad had a fruit and vegetable truck, and so I could always go out to the truck and get, there was none of the binge foods really, but I could always binge on apples and peas in the pod and whatever it was. And when I felt some kind of discomfort, I could just go out to my dad's fruit and vegetable truck. And I guess it's a good thing although he did, before I was born, work for See's Candy. Fortunately, at that time, he didn't. I would have been in big trouble. But junior high school was when I really recall using food as a way of escape. My memories of high school and junior high school really are about nutrition and lunch. I don't have a whole lot of other memories, you know. I can tell you what I ate for nutrition. I can tell you what I ate, or not what I ate, what I binged on for nutrition and lunch. I mean, so many things that I didn't realize at the time, but food was really my way of dealing with growing up, because I thought that everybody else, I mean, in grammar school I was popular and I got good grades and I was a good athlete, and junior high came and boys and girls started noticing each other a little bit more, and I thought for sure that all these people had a book of rules, and I just didn't get one, you know. And so I just kind of withdrew into myself and into my food. I remember when I was in high school, there are four siblings in the family, and during high school, my dad and I built on the laundry room attached to the garage, we built a room. So this was going to be my place. You know, I was away from the family, you know, in the backyard and all to myself. And the first night I slept out there, I remember what I did. My ultimate statement of freedom, I remember that I bought a bag of orange slices, the candy orange slices. That was it. You know, that I could eat that without having to worry about my folks catching me sneaking food, because I was a sneak eater. And that was freedom. That was as much as I knew. When I went away to college, between high school and college, I spent the summer eating a lot of carrots and celery and running around the block a lot. And I went to college and I was thin for the first time in a long time. And I do, I've heard, you know, thin isn't well, but thin is a whole lot better for me than being fat. So I thought that life was going to be different. And it was to some degree, but the truth is that I didn't learn anything about what was driving me to the food. And so I was away from college for a semester, came back to UCLA and fell in love for the real serious first time. And my girlfriend smoked cigarettes, and that started me smoking cigarettes. And we had kind of an on-again, off-again relationship. And, you know, when we were off, me and food were on. And that really became a pattern for me for a long, long time. When when we finally broke up, and I remember going away to college, I went away to San Francisco. And that was another sense of freedom. And my freedom allowed me to get into drugs pretty wholeheartedly. And from that, experienced a couple of episodes. Not from that, I don't want, because that's the way my parents thought. They thought that my drugs were the source of my craziness. The truth was, my craziness was the source of my craziness. I spent two episodes in mental hospitals, one in Camarillo and one in St. John's Hospital. And both of those were fairly similar episodes. I really lost touch with my own ground of being. I fell in love with a woman that was inaccessible. And by inaccessible, I don't mean that she was personally that. She was a celebrity. And I met her, and I had created a fantasy around it. I'm a songwriter, and she's a songwriter. And I really thought that I was going to pursue her. And it really ended me up in Camarillo. And when I came out of the mental hospital, I got involved in meditation. Somehow there was a glimmer of understanding that perhaps there was something wrong up here and that I really needed to deal with my mental condition. So I got involved with meditation for the first time. And I bring that up, and so I will give a little plug for the meditation workshop. But I bring it up because it was and is crucial to my recovery. Without it, I don't know what I would do with the voices that would say, oh, go ahead and eat this. This isn't going to hurt you. Or that would allow me to even wrestle with food, which I don't do anymore at all. There is no, well, should I or shouldn't I? That, because I know where that always goes. And meditation has been real helpful in that area. But I wasn't in OA at the time that I started meditation. And so I didn't put it together. I mean, I, like probably most of you, knew all the good nutrition facts and what you should and shouldn't do, but as they say, self-knowledge will avail you nothing. And I mean, I was ready to write a diet book. Because I had done so many of them, and I had all this great information, and I thought that the world needed it. And, of course, it didn't do me any good, because, like everything else in my life, I really lived my life from about here up. And it took, well, let me get to the place of real crisis. Got married, and my ex-wife and I were both smokers, and that was like one of the things we had in common. I mean, there were a few other things, but I mean, that was one of the things. And I went on a fast during our marriage, and like many fasts throughout the time that I was an overeater, it was always to lose weight. And I would fast. One year I remember fasting one day a week for a whole year. And for those of you taking notes, I will tell you that it worked. It kept my weight at a certain level for a year. And of course, I had headaches every week. And it was just a very unpleasant experience, but it was one of the many things I tried. And then I remember breaking up with this woman that I had lived with, and I went on a two-week fast. And that was the first time I think I broke up that I didn't become a yo-yo. And so I sort of became dedicated to fasting. And every once in a while I would fast for 2 weeks. And it would be a way of losing weight. But this time that I was fasting, and this was towards the end of my marriage, all this time I had been a smoker, even during fasting. You know, and for those of you that have done fasting, you get really clean inside. And I don't know how I could possibly have smoked through all that, but I did. And this time, for some reason, it became clear to me that I didn't want to put that smoke in my body. And so every time I'd go for a cigarette, it was just very apparent that two things were happening. One was that it was habit. You know, for some reason I felt some slight, it could be just the slightest bit of discomfort or whatever, and I'd go for the cigarette. And the other thing was that it's hard to really get my finger. Let me just stay with that for now. Anyway, so I stopped smoking at that time. I had no intention of stopping, but this is 20 years now, and I never smoked again, and I never wanted to. And the reason I always bring that up is because had I known then that food was the same thing, it's a matter of habit and some kind of a feeling that pushes you towards it. And so I got it with the cigarettes, and I stopped. And, of course, once I stopped smoking, my ex-wife and I had nothing in common anymore. And so our marriage ended, and I dealt with it the way I usually dealt with the end of a relationship, and use food. And for about 2 years, I would be binging. And I remember for a while, I lived with this guy out in the valley, and that's how I got from the city to the valley, and in this big house. And I did what I typically did when I had roommates, and that was I would borrow their food. I've never paid anybody back that I borrowed food from. But, when I lived with people that weren't compulsive overeaters and they had stuff in the house, I never bought that stuff. But so if they had it, I would borrow it, assuming that they would never miss it. And so I would always binge on other people's food in that way. I was a sneak eater then, too. So I was getting heavier and heavier, and I moved out of that situation. I was living alone at the time, and I remember it so well. I was living in Sherman Oaks, and I was getting to the place where it was time to take care of business. You imagine most of us get to a place, there's either a magic number or it's a certain sense of disgust with yourself, and you decide, I'm going to do something. And I'm going to get serious. And so I did. And every morning I'd get up and I would vow that today was going to be the day that I was going to, eliminate this problem. And I would come up with some kind of an interesting diet. Never three meals a day. That never occurred to me. That was not at all intriguing or tantalizing or anything. So I'd come up with something. And I would always make it through dinner time. And at dinner, I remember so well how it felt. I would be sitting at the dinner table, and the food would be going into my body. I wouldn't be experiencing it or tasting it or anything. I'd be tasting mainly my fear. My fear that, I had dieted all day and there's nothing in the house that, I kind of really want right now. And I mean, this is my last meal. And so, I was like a junkie. It was no question in my mind when I came into this program that I was like an alcoholic or a drug addict, because I was just trembling. I tried so hard again today to deal with this problem, and I was successful up till dinner time. But as soon as I was done with dinner, I was out the door, and I would get as much as it took to make me feel safe for the rest of the night. And I discovered in this program that safety is a very important thing for me, that food and binging was a lot of it had to do with feeling safe. Because even though at the end of the night, after I had just binged my brains out, because I'd always go to the store and I'd always get more than enough, because I didn't want to have to go back again, And after that, all that shame and all that disgust was better than having to face a feeling I wasn't familiar with. What was it like to be alone and be divorced? I didn't know. I didn't really allow myself to feel any of that. But I knew what it felt like to feel ashamed and to feel, just bloated and all of that stuff. So as bad as it felt safe. It was predictable. I didn't understand that at the time. But I did this same thing every day. I'd get up, bright-eyed optimist, talk about willpower. I had willpower, if I decided I was going to have a Snickers bar, nothing could stop me. I have willpower. But the same thing would happen at dinner time. I was all over. And I did this day after day after day. And finally, I got them. Something came through. And my sense was I experienced two things. One, my worst fear had come true. I had tried my best, and I couldn't do it. I was going to be fat for the rest of my life. My worst fear. Right? And the only thing that got me through was the other little glimmer. I won't say hope, but what it was the sense that, as a dieter, I was always fighting myself. I was always twisted against myself. We're compulsive overeaters. And if you look up compulsion in the dictionary, you'll find you don't have a choice. You're compelled. So as a dieter, I was always standing in front of the ocean and trying to push it back. And there was no way I could do that. And suddenly, I realized I didn't have to do that anymore. I knew I couldn't do that. I had failed. And there was something ultimately freeing about that. That I took the first step without realizing it. I knew I was powerless. I really, in every cell in my body, I knew I was powerless. I didn't have to lie to myself anymore. I didn't have to prove anything to my parents or to society. The game was over. I had lost. But I there's something about the dignity of not having to have to fight yourself anymore that I found somewhat liberating among all this despair. Because I didn't have the hope of this program. And so for about... This woman told me about OA. I didn't know OA existed. I knew about AA, but I didn't know about OA. And I went to a meeting, and I went for about 2 weeks. And this was back in... my first meeting was Valentine's Day of 1983. And I went for about 2 weeks looking for ways to poke holes in the balloon. And I don't like organizations. I don't like being told what to believe. Like I say, I was a meditator. I was on a spiritual path. I believed in God. God was a very convenient intellectual belief. Now, never had to really put it to the test. But I didn't want to be told what to believe. I didn't want to be... I have to join anything. But I had nowhere else to turn. And if they had told me about a diet, I would have been gone. Because I had tried them all. And I knew about them. So I didn't really want to hear that. And all my objections got answered. And finally, after 2 weeks, I got a sponsor. And I was at a meeting at the Valley office. And there was a guy there that had something I wanted. And he had a glow about him. And so I went up to him after the meeting and I said, can I call you? Or actually, I think he came up to me. I can't remember exactly. But I didn't go up to him and say, will you be my sponsor? I didn't have the nerve to do that. But I did say, can I call you? And so we had coffee, and he gave me some things to do that had to do with processing my feelings. And I thought the only feeling I really had ultimately was hunger. I thought anything that was a little bit strange to me that I couldn't really put my finger on or feel was hunger. And I always responded to it as hunger. And so over the weekend, I had a long conversation with God. And I like I say, I was on a spiritual path, but I was not on a path of talking to God. That was not part of this process. But they said that half measures avail you nothing. And I had no place else to turn. I was desperate. I was unhappy. I was miserable. And so my sense was that I was walking a tightrope and there was no net below it. If God wasn't there to catch me, I was going to come crashing down pretty hard because I was willing to embrace this program. Not because I believed it, but because I didn't have anywhere else to turn. And so I was willing to try. And so I woke up on Monday morning, and I knew something had happened because instead of getting up and making a beeline to the kitchen, you know, I got up, did what I had to do. When I did finally have breakfast, I had a serving of this and a serving of that. I never thought servings were for real. I never believed that. That's for other people. And I ate what I said I was going to eat. And I remember in between breakfast and lunch, I went to the market because he made it clear that, you know, you should have things in the house that for the week so that you don't do impulsive buying. And he also said something to me that really stunned me. He said, "I want you to enjoy your food." That to me was remarkable. All my life as a dieter, food was always a matter of either doing penance or going hog wild. And so, oh, okay, you mean I can enjoy my food? All right, I'll try that. And that has changed my relationship with food dramatically. I really like food today. When I hear people talking about we got to walk the line 3 times a day, to me, I don't relate to that. I get to eat 3 times a day, and I enjoy every one of those. And when I'm done, I'm done. And that's it. But anyways, so I had had breakfast that first morning, and I went to the market, and I'm standing in front of the salad dressing, and I'm there for a while contemplating, you know, the right dressing. Again, I want to do this right now. And I'm starting to have these hunger thoughts. And I say thoughts because they're not feelings. I just ate. How could I feel hunger? And he suggested, you know, when certain things happen like this and are inappropriate, I want you to start writing. And I had my trusty book with me. I mean, I was willing to do all this stuff. And I started writing and writing and writing. And suddenly I realized that there was this gal a couple aisles down that I was attracted to. And you know, I completely ignored it. And I'm there in front of the salad dressing. And what I'm really feeling is lust. And I thought, wow. That wasn't hunger, that was lust. You know? And that was just the first of many experiences where I could feel feelings that I thought ultimately were hunger. Because I thought they were all hunger. And that first day was incredible for me. And I thought for sure that I was just having a great day and that tomorrow was going to be different because I was used to going on diets, you know, and you can have a good day or you can even have a good week, you know, but it ends. You know, if some emotion happens to hit you, you know, life intrudes and boom, you're back to your old way of being. But the next day I got up and it was that way too. You know, that emptiness that I was always trying to fill with food got filled. And it was just that was I was on different footing. You know, when you read in the big book about Bill talking about being on different footing, I was on different footing. This wasn't a diet. You know, it's funny because I remember trying to convince my folks that this was something different because they were compulsive overeaters themselves, and they couldn't relate to that. They didn't understand it. But it's not a diet. You know, and I will never diet again. The weight loss was the easiest weight loss because for me it was not a struggle. I was not battling myself anymore. That was done. The weight just came off. And of course what scared me was I can tend to get cocky and after I've lost my weight in diets, what do? I just, you know, okay, now I can have a little bit of this and a little bit of that and just, you know, I can handle this. I'm on top of it because I did it. You know, well, I knew I didn't do it. I knew that, I mean, I play a part in it. But I know I don't do this alone. It's, you know, my higher power is doing for me what I can't do for myself. And the people in this program also help support me. So I don't have any illusion about where this strength and power come from. But when I lost all that weight, my fear was, what's going to keep me around here? Because it came off very quickly. What's going to keep me around here? I'll tell you what's kept me around here for, it's been 18 and a half years. What's kept me around here is the sanity. That's why I always talk about my little trips to the mental institutions. Because I know what insanity is like. I used to be very flippant about that, but I know what it's like. I really do. And this program gives me a sanity today that is an incredible blessing in my life. That gives me the real freedom. It's not orange slices anymore. It's the freedom to go through life consciously and not have to numb it out with food. That allows me to experience what we're going through in these days. And I was in the Twin Towers about a month and a half ago. So I felt, somewhat of a connection with that. But I just felt this thing just go right through my heart. Those planes going through the towers were like just going through my heart. And I don't think I could have felt that before. And the anger that I feel, I was a protester in the Vietnam War. So I didn't feel that sense of a sense of pride in my country. In the same way that, when I was growing up, I don't think I felt that connected to my family in that way. When I became recovered, I really found that my parents gave me a lot that I never appreciated because I was so angry about my condition. And so it's an incredible blessing for me to live the way that I can live today in spite of what we're going through. And let me see if I can wrap it up a little bit. I'll tell you what I do today. My life is fairly simple in terms of what I do in this program. I try and stay connected to the people that I can be close to and let know who I am and be real with. I make sure that I go to the market once a week still and get the food that I know is good for me. I call my food in every morning. I tended to write it down before I called it in, but I just had the inside of my house painted, and so I can't even find the papers that I write it down. But I know pretty much what I'm going to eat, and I call it in, and that keeps me honest. And, bless this guy, he when I call, his answering machine's on. So I tell an answering machine most of the time. It's okay, because I feel just as much committed to what I commit to as somebody once told me, you could call the operator and tell her or him, if they still answer. I don't know if you still can call the operator. But it's a way of, it's like from you to God's ears. And that's what it is for me. I say a prayer before each meal. And I don't have to say it out loud. But I do that because that keeps me from doing a swan dive into the food. Now, for me, if I were to give this program in its simplest form, I would say it's all about having no God in front of God. And that includes food and anything else. God is my higher power. Before, I could have had all the religion. God was up here. It was an intellectual belief. It didn't cost me anything. But, when it came down to it, my higher power was food. That's where I really went to seek my sustenance, to seek my comfort. And so if I would simplify this program in any way, and I do think this is a simple program. The only thing that I think is hard in this program is this, but God comes first. So when I say I'm abstinent, abstinence for me is my covenant with my higher power. My food plan is going to be different from your food plan, I guarantee you. But that's the strategy. And how you work it is how you work it. If you eat sugar and it works for you, great. I'm not a fanatic in this program. I remember when I was living with a woman and I was a vegetarian, and I can make a religion out of anything. So it's not that at all. And so for me, my abstinence is my covenant with my higher power. my higher power does for me what I cannot do for myself, and I know that I could not handle food today if it was not for that relationship. And it's up to me to keep that relationship strong. And my food plan, well, for me it is 3 meals a day, nothing in between. It's fairly simple. But it's, you know, it's the food that I like. Like I said, you know, I enjoy my food. I love mangoes, and so I have mangoes as often as I can. I mean, you know, not to excess, but I have them most every day. And other things that I enjoy. And meditation is very important to me still. And the people, like I say, that I'm close to, and I try and remain close. You know, sponsorship for me is a two-way street. You know, the people that I'm closest to and that I can be most intimate with are the people that I started out sponsoring. And I can go to them as easily as they can go to me. And that's a real gift. I think I've said it. I think I've said it. I'm real grateful for this program and all the blessings that it's given me. So thank you for listening. Yeah, sure. Okay. I guess in the time remaining, if you have any questions, shoot. Yeah, in the wake of all that's happened during this week, how has that affected my relationship with God? That's a great question. That's a really great question. I'd be dishonest if I said that it's changed dramatically, because, you know, my relationship with God takes me through whatever it takes me through. But it certainly is, as I am, given me a lot more gratitude. I know that without a relationship with God, it would be very, very hard. I mean, it is very hard to go live through these times, but it would be much, much harder. And I know that without that relationship, it would be food. That would be where I'd be going. Prayer seems to be a lot more vital these days. I find myself being a lot more panoramic in my view of who I pray for. But I also, I guess, I find that my God allows me to have a lot of latitude in terms of what I feel. Because I feel a lot of anger underneath a lot of this sadness. And there's something I think about my relationship with God that is an honesty factor. So it allows me to trust. I've learned through this program to trust what I feel. Not necessarily to worship what I feel, but to trust it, to process it, that it's very important, and to honor it. And I think all those things that I've learned because I've had a higher power guide me through that. Yeah.
Yeah, we have a few newcomers here. Any suggestions or experiences with your four-step inventory format and amends that you think would be valuable for people looking for that guidance?
Okay, obviously important things. I've taken a few inventories over the years, a few big ones, and I remember the first inventory. It was one that I think it came from I don't know where. It was huge. It was a real inventory, and I remember getting, so it took me quite a bit of time, and I remember getting stuck. And you know where I got stuck? Procrastination. I thought that was really interesting. I'm never going to finish understanding all my character defects with regard to procrastination, because I'm going to keep procrastinating. So, on one hand, I was very serious about it, but I think you have to also have a little bit of lightness about it, because, you know, I remember, you know, I wanted to do this thing so right, as if there was a right. There is no right way to do an inventory other than to do it honestly. There are just inventory after inventory. It's about getting honest with yourself. It's about looking inside, starting to, you know, we look so long towards the food that anything that you start to do in that process to help you look inside is gonna help. With regard to making amends, well, I remember some of the early amends that I made. You know, there were things I borrowed that I thought that, you know, it was no big deal, and I really was willing to humiliate myself. I thought, you know, I don't think there was any amend that I made that really humiliated me ultimately, other than it was my fear that of what might happen. Made an amend to my dad, both while he was alive, and also while he was dying, when he wasn't even conscious. He may or may not have heard me. I made an amend to my ex-wife 10 years after our divorce, and it was really a very beautiful moment because all the things that I used to be very flippant, kind of a, you know, take my wife, you know, and all the kind of jokey, you know, all the things she did to me, but never really looked at it very seriously. I wasn't ready to, and then 10 years into this program, I was ready to, and it wasn't a painful divorce. It wasn't like a lot of people. It was really we remained friends, but still, it was not something that I was ready to embrace right away. And we met for lunch, and we'd been in contact for what we call and wish each other happy birthday over the years, but this was 10 years after our divorce. And we met for lunch, and she told me she was about to get married. And when I told her all the things that I thought I had done wrong, and she seemed not to have, they were a much bigger deal to me than they were to her. And I felt a real genuine happiness for her that I hadn't screwed her up and that she was able to, you know, get married again. That made me feel good, and I really welcomed it. And so it was one of the most joyful amends that I made. So I guess in answer to your question, stay open. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Well, I don't think it, because of that there have been a couple of relationships that have ended, and a best friend who I went into an investment with. I mean, he was a best friend for almost 30 years, and I experienced more pain with that breakup than with my marriage. But I don't recall, you know, specifically, oh, I've got to get this person out of my life for the sake of abstinence. I never felt that experience. I've heard people talk about that, and you know, I don't really feel like there have been people that have been severely poisonous in my life any more than I've been poisonous in theirs. So no. Yeah.
I'm fairly new. Did you ever have doubts about coming back and wanting to be here? And if you did, how did you overcome that?
Yeah, she says she's new and has. Have I ever had any doubts about coming back to, and how did I deal with that? About being here. No. But I've heard that, and I understand that. I mean, for me, and I learned this from growing up Jewish, I think. At a certain point, I had to realize it could be any tradition. It has nothing to do with being Jewish. It's just, I always kind of rebelled against that for a long time, and what I misunderstood was that I thought that the people that I associated with, that kind of like the cloying relatives of mine that just drove me nuts, that was what it was about. And I've heard people get driven away because they didn't like some of the people here. And you know something? I don't like some of the people here. I don't think I could go anywhere and like everybody. So it's real clear to me that OA is not the specific personalities here. OA to me isn't, although us people do carry this message, but OA is embraced by the 12 steps, and that's where you'll find OA. So you can go to a meeting anywhere. You know, I have meetings in coffee shops or, you know, in a car. Doesn't matter. To me, OA is not the meetings, although meetings can be very, very important. And I need to make a distinction between that and understand those 12 steps have never failed me. I've never doubted them. The only steps I had before this program was right to the kitchen. And today, those guide me. Okay, one more.
Building on the same question, how do you, when you really, if somebody really pisses you off, how do you practice bringing them to the program?
Okay, if somebody really pisses me off, how do I practice the principles of the program and not have to make an amends, do something I have to make an amends for? Well, you know what? I'm not a saint. And sometimes I do have to make amends. Sometimes I screw up. And that's okay. You know, that's why we have those amends. I mean, I don't go out of my way to because I don't particularly like to have to make amends all the time. But, you know, I found it much easier, you know, to make those amends than to have to carry it around. It's a real, I know the discomfort I feel when I'm off. You know, when you're not eating over it, you feel that stuff. And it's much more painful to hold on to that stuff than to make amends. And, I'll, you know, some that'll just tell me, you know, just as I was driven to the food, I get driven to those amends. You know, so, you know, I do my best to be a good person, but, you know, I screw up. And that's okay. So, I guess that's it. I thank you for letting me share.